Films in Focus with David Sterrett is underwritten by The Movie House, your destination for first-run Hollywood and independent movies, and a digital portal to the Met Opera, National Theater Live, and special events worldwide in Millerton, New York, and on the web, themoviehouse.net.
Doesn't seem to be anything more to say there, does it?
As you can maybe guess from these titles, this is a very, very variegated batch of movies this week. They're all of interest for different reasons, and in my opinion, they kind of get better as they go along from one to the next. But let us begin with The Northman. This is the new movie by Robert Eggers, who is a director who specializes in horror films. His first movie was a movie called The Witch, which is it's a very good horror film. I actually looked at it again just recently, and I have to say, for some reason, it never quite grabs me. It never quite becomes horrific for me. But it's a very beautifully made movie about witchcraft and horrible things that happen to a family that is out in the isolated wilds. Anyway, then he made a movie called The Lighthouse, which the first time I saw it, I was not very impressed by it, starring Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe. But I looked at that also again recently, and it really improved for me. Right now, I really think that is Eggers' best movie, The Lighthouse, about a couple of crusty old salts who are in an isolated lighthouse in the middle of nowhere and various horrible things going on around them. The Northman is also a horror movie, but of a very different kind. It's very historical, as in their ways were both of those movies. But here, it's really just a great big galumphing action movie. It has an excellent cast. It has Alexander Skarsgård and Nicole Kidman and Ethan Hawke and Anya Taylor-Joy and Willem Dafoe again, who is sort of a regular for Eggers. And it's a very well-made movie, but my gosh, I was hoping for something more than just an action movie, and that really is basically what it is. So what we have here, we are up somewhere with the Vikings, there is a young Viking prince. We first meet him as a boy, and his father is murdered before his eyes by his uncle, and he has to avenge his father's murder, and basically the whole movie is this great quest by this young boy who then obviously grows up, that's what it's about. So again, it's all very well done, but the whole thing really reminded me of Game of Thrones. This is really like a sort of a fair to middling Game of Thrones episode. I am quite an admirer of Game of Thrones. I found the narrative of it sort of semi-impenetrable, but it had some marvelous, marvelous set pieces along the way, some of them big action set pieces and some of them really sort of deep psychological set pieces that really worked very, very well. The Northman has all the action, but none of the psychological interest. And I compare it with Game of Thrones because it really, really, really reminded me of that. But again, it's sort of like an unremarkable episode of Game of Thrones. Very impressive for its visual qualities, its audio-visual qualities, but my golly, it just never really took a hold of me in any emotional sense at all. It's pretty long. It's well over 2 hours, and anybody who likes action and anybody who really thinks that Robert Eggers is one of the great modern filmmakers should definitely run out and see it, but it just somehow never got me. I respect its craft. I respect its terrific cast, which is really marvelous. I didn't even mention that Bjork is in it as well. Everybody's in it, somehow it's a good movie without ever becoming anything close to a great movie. And I don't think I'll be remembering its details very long. So The Northman, I would say, if you're into this kind of huge epic action, by all means, run out and see it. But it just never quite got a hold of me. Second movie today, Jill, is very, very different. Dear Mr. Brody. Now we have a documentary directed by Keith Maitland, and it is about a guy named Michael Brody Jr., who way back in 1970 decided he was going to give away a huge amount of money. It turns out that in 1970, I sort of remember this, $25 million was an enormous amount of money. Nowadays, with all these billionaires running around, that seems like pocket change. But Michael Brody Jr. had this $25 million. He was the heir to an oleomargin fortune, and he decided he was going to give this money away. And he was not going to give it away in some sort of organized manner, give it to big charities or maybe start his own charitable foundation. He just announced very publicly he was going to give it to anybody who wanted some of it, anybody who asks for some of it. He would just give them money. okay, that's very interesting. And again, this all really happened. This is a documentary. So what happened? Well, he really started getting a lot of requests, which is not too surprising. He got an enormous number of letters, which is why the movie is called Dear Mr. Brody. He would give out his address, his home address, his office address, and the letters would flood in. And then sometimes people would make personal requests to him. They would show up in front of his house, or they would show up at his office. And oh, this became very, very difficult. Now, why did Michael Brody Jr. simply announce he was going to give away his $25 million to anybody who asked for it? Well, he was basically a hippie. And he is very much a character in the movie, in old footage from the period. We see him clutching his acoustic guitar and saying hippie things and doing hippie things. And he is there with his girlfriend, who very quickly after became his wife. And she is definitely, one sort of stereotype of the hippie chick of the period. I was around in 1970. I remember people like that. And so there they are. But after a while, in fact, after a very, very, very short while, this requests for the money, which he started this whole thing, remember? He was the one who was going to give away all this money. He was the one who decided that's what I should do with my fortune. And by the way, he always said, I'm not giving away money, I'm giving away love. This is all about love. Well, of course, it was also all about money. And anyway, it became a horrible burden for him. And well, I'm not going to give total spoilers here, but he came to an unfortunately bad end. Now, the director of this movie, Keith Maitland, has come up with a whole lot of archival material. There's a lot of footage of Brody and his wife back in the day. A very important film person who I used to know back in my New York days plays a part in the movie, Edward R. Pressman, a very, very, very illustrious movie producer. I used to know Ed, and he was a terrific guy, and he decided he was going to make a movie about Brody during the brief period of time when all this was unfolding. And he appears in the movie in his present-day self looking back on all of this, and it turns out he had a whole lot of the letters that Brody received. And those letters, again, the title is Dear Mr. Brody. They definitely play a part in this movie. And so that's what the movie is about. Now, I got to give a little bit of spoiler stuff here, because you sort of have to know how all this comes out. Because as you're watching the movie, you think, well, how long did this go on? What eventually happened to all of his money? What eventually happened to Brody himself? Well, again, he was a hippie, and it turns out as the movie goes along, he got pretty much involved in drugs. And in fact, he may have been drugged up when he said some of this stuff and when he set some of this stuff in motion. And eventually, by the way, this whole thing unspooled in a very, very short period of time. This whole phenomenon was really fly by night. It started, it ran its course very, very quickly, and then it ended. And he ended too. He died in his middle 20s, and drugs were totally the cause of that. It's very, very sad. So that's what eventually happened to him. But in the meanwhile, there was this flurry of fabulous activity in which some famous people were briefly involved. And it's pretty fascinating to watch it unfold. In a way, this movie is a great time capsule. It really brings us back to a period when there were hippies abroad in the land. And when people could say things publicly like, I have $25 million and I'm going to give it all away. And people took him seriously and he meant it seriously. But the unintended consequences proved to be overwhelmingly vast. And again, the whole thing came to a pretty sorry end for him. His wife is still around, and she appears in the movie herself, or I should say his widow. So it's really quite a fascinating story. Now, the movie really overindulges the sentimentality that comes along here. Long stretches in the movie. And by the way, some people, this will be their favorite feature of the film. It was my least favorite feature of the film. We have people opening some of these. A lot of these letters, by the way, that he received were never even opened. And so we have people now opening the letters and reading from the letters, and all of these, oh, these sad tales of people who want money for this reason and money for that reason, and it's all very poignant. One of the things that interested me is that most people don't ask for $20 million. Most of the people are asking for a few $100s or a few $1,000s. It's sort of sweet the way people are not making these overly huge demands, but we do have a whole lot of time in the movie spent reading from these letters and seeing photos in in some cases that were enclosed with the letters. And that's all very sentimental and it's nice. But I really preferred the parts of the movie that told about Brody's weird quixotic thing that he set in motion and what eventually became of it all. Those parts of the movie are riveting. So, dear Mr. Brody, a mixed bag of a movie for me. The treatment of the topic as a movie is not distinguished, but it's a very, very interesting subject. And I had a good time watching it. It's widely streaming and, you know, people might want to catch up with it. Again, fascinating time capsule back to around 1970, the early 70s. And our last movie today, Jill, is my favorite of the bunch, and I think it's one of the absolute very best movies that I've seen so far this year. It has what must be one of the most misleading titles in movie history. We're All Going to the World's Fair. What in the world is that about? Well, it turns out to be the very opposite of what that title might suggest to people. At the very beginning of the movie, we have a young woman, an adolescent, in fact. Her name is Casey, and she is gazing into her computer screen. And it is a very, very long shot that goes on for quite a while. And she's just gazing at this computer screen. And then she tells her computer screen and tells apparently, she apparently is communicating with people on YouTube or some such outlet. And she tells us that she is going to take the World's Fair Challenge now. And that is what sets the movie in motion. And that's why the movie is called We're All Going to the World's Fair. So what is the World's Fair challenge that this young woman is going to take? Well, this is a horror movie. It's a very gentle and delicate and understated horror movie, but it is a horror movie. And the World's Fair challenge turns out to be something, well, it's apparently some sort of internet craze. And what you do is you say, I want to go to the World's Fair three times into your computer screen, and then you prick your finger to make some blood come out, and then you do one or two other little things, and then you are now involved in the World's Fair Challenge. You start to watch videos that come up, and you make your own videos. And so she starts that all in motion, and then she says, I'll report back to you folks about any changes that take place. And then we discover that people who take the World's Fair Challenge, and these are all young netheads, they're all young people involved in the internet and involved in their YouTube channels and stuff like this. It turns out that if you take the World Fair Challenge, what supposedly happens to you is that changes take place in you. Changes take place in your mind and in your body. And we see little videos that people have posted online, and we see that changes are taking place in their bodies. Some of them apparently are pretty horrible changes, sort of like disease changes. Some of them are maybe more exotic or maybe more hard to put your finger on. And that's what's going on. And that, by the way, is what the whole movie consists of. It all consists of stuff that's being posted on video or that's been posted on video, and the whole movie is a great online experience. Sometimes we do see Casey. She walks about, and she goes through her world, and she's out in the real world. At one point, we even hear her father shouting up to her from somewhere else in the house, keep down the noise, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. So there are other people in this world, and she's not always online as we watch her. But if she's not online as we watch her, she's at least posting something that will be online. So this movie is totally wrapped up in the internet from start to finish. Now, how does all this play out? Well, I certainly won't give any spoilers on this one. The point is, this is a horror movie, and it is very much about the horror of the loneliness and also the communication that takes place when you are on the internet. And of course, it reflects that fact which we have seen play out in other movies before now, some of them horror movies, some of them science fiction movies, some of them not, that the information superhighway has cracks in it, has potholes in it, has dangerous curves and detours and places where you might go off the track and end up crashing. And that is very much what this movie is about. Now, one of the greatest assets of this movie is the person who plays Casey. She is a very young actor named Anna Cobb, and we are told at the beginning of the film that this is her first, in fact, the opening credits, this is her very first movie. She's never been in a movie before. Well, she is phenomenal. And We're All Going to the World's Fair is a very inventively made movie. It tells a story unlike any other I've ever seen, and it tells it in a hugely compelling way. I was riveted through pretty much every moment of it. But a large part of the credit of that goes to Anna Cobb, who plays Casey. It is an extraordinary performance, an astonishing performance. And this appears to be one of the most gifted young actors to come along in a very long while. Now, whether or not she's going to be able to do other remarkable, amazing things along the way, we'll see. But it's an extraordinary performance, and it really anchors this film. There's really only one other character who gets much screen time, and that is a man named JLB, played by Michael J. Rogers, also very well done. But this is very much Anna Cobb's film as Casey, and it is very, very much Jane Schoenbrunn's film. She is the writer and director. I should say they, because this is a trans person. Jane Schoenbrunn, an extraordinarily amazing film, remarkable, riveting, unconventional, tries something that's never really been tried before and pulls it off brilliantly. Again, one of the best movies I've seen so far this year. We're all going to the World's Fair. Anybody interested in horror, in creepiness, or in the internet should rush off and see it. It's streaming widely. It's a remarkable movie. We're all going to the World's Fair. So that is my somewhat not exactly festive story this week, Jill.
That said, we're all going to the World's Fair. Thank you very much, David Sterrett. Films in Focus. The films, The Northmen, Dear Mr. Brody, and We're All Going to the World's Fair.